This is Audible.
Mao's Great Famine by Frank Dakota, narrated by David Balcom. The author opens the book with the following quote.
Revolution is not a dinner party. Mao Zedong.
And now, Mao's Great Famine.
Preface. Between 1958 and 1962, China descended into hell. Mao Zedong, chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, threw his country into a frenzy with the Great Leap Forward, an attempt to catch up with and overtake Britain in less than 15 years. By unleashing China's greatest asset, a labor force that was counted in the hundreds of millions, Mao thought that he could catapult his country past its competitors. Instead of following the Soviet model of development, which leaned heavily towards industry alone, China would walk on two legs. The peasant masses were mobilized to transform both agriculture and industry at the same time, converting a backward economy into a modern communist society of plenty for all. In the pursuit of a utopian paradise, everything was collectivized, as villages were herded together in giant communes which heralded the advent of communism. People in the countryside were robbed of their work, their homes, their land, their belongings, and their livelihood. Food, distributed by the spoonful in collective canteens according to merit, became a weapon to force people to follow the party's every dictate. Irrigation campaigns forced up to half the villagers to work for weeks on end on giant water conservancy projects, often far from home, without adequate food and rest. The experiment ended in the greatest catastrophe the country had ever known, destroying tens of millions of lives. Unlike comparable disasters, for instance those that took place under Pol Pot, Adolf Hitler, or Joseph Stalin, the true dimensions of what happened during the Great Leap Forward remain little known. This is because access to the party archives has long been restricted to all but the most trusted historians backed up with party credentials. But a new archive law has recently opened up vast quantities of archival material to professional historians, fundamentally changing the way one can study the Maoist era. This book is based on well over 1,000 archival documents collected over several years in dozens of party archives, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Beijing and large provincial collections in Hebei, Shandong, Gansu, Hubei, Hunan, Zhejiang, Sichuan, Guizhou, Yunnan, and Guangdong, to smaller but equally invaluable collections in cities and counties all over China. The material includes secret reports from the Public Security Bureau, detailed minutes of top party meetings, unexpurgated versions of important leadership speeches, surveys of working conditions in the countryside, investigations into cases of mass murder, confessions of leaders responsible for the deaths of millions of people, inquiries compiled by special teams sent in to discover the extent of the catastrophe in the last stages of the Great Leap Forward, general reports on peasant resistance during the collectivization campaign, secret opinion surveys, letters of complaint written by ordinary people, and much more. What comes out of this massive and detailed dossier transforms our understanding of the Great Leap Forward. When it comes to the overall death toll, for instance, researchers so far have had to extrapolate from official population statistics, including the census figures of 1953, 1964, and 1982. Their estimates range from 15 to 32 million excess deaths. But the public security reports compiled at the time, as well as the voluminous secret reports collated by party committees in the last months of the Great Leap Forward, show how inadequate these calculations are, pointing instead at a catastrophe of a much greater magnitude. This book shows that at least 45 million people died unnecessarily between 1958 and 1962. The term famine, or even Great Famine, is often used to describe these 4 to 5 years of the Maoist era, but the term fails to capture the many ways in which people died under radical collectivization. The blithe use of the term famine also lends support to the widespread view that these deaths were the unintended consequence of half-baked and poorly executed economic programs. Mass killings are not usually associated with Mao and the Great Leap Forward, and China continues to benefit from a more favorable comparison with the devastation often associated with Cambodia or the Soviet Union. But as the fresh evidence presented in this book demonstrates, coercion, terror, and systematic violence were the foundation of the Great Leap Forward. Thanks to the often meticulous reports compiled by the party itself, we can infer that between 1958 and 1962, by a rough approximation, 6 to 8% of the victims were tortured to death or summarily killed, amounting to at least 2.5 million people. Other victims were deliberately deprived of food and starved to death. Many more vanished because they were too old, weak, or sick to work, and hence unable to earn their keep. People were killed selectively because they were rich, because they dragged their feet, because they spoke out, or simply because they were not liked, for whatever reason, by the man who wielded the ladle in the canteen. Countless people were killed indirectly through neglect, as local cadres were under pressure to focus on figures rather than on people, making sure they fulfilled the targets they were handed by the top planners. A vision of promised abundance not only motivated one of the most deadly mass killings of human history, but also inflicted unprecedented damage on agriculture, trade, industry, and transportation. Pots, pans, and tools were thrown into backyard furnaces to increase the country's steel output, which was seen as one of the magic markers of progress. Livestock declined precipitously, not only because animals were slaughtered for the export market, but also because they succumbed en masse to disease and hunger, despite extravagant schemes for giant piggeries that would bring meat to every table. Waste developed because raw resources and supplies were poorly allocated, and because factory bosses deliberately bent the rules to increase output. As everyone cut corners in the relentless pursuit of higher output, factories spewed out inferior goods that accumulated uncollected by railway sidings. Corruption seeped into the fabric of life, tainting everything from soy sauce to hydraulic dams. The transportation system creaked to a halt before collapsing altogether, unable to cope with the demands created by a command economy. Goods worth hundreds of millions of yuan accumulated in canteens, dormitories, and even on the streets, a lot of the stock simply rotting or rusting away. It would have been difficult to design a more wasteful system, one in which grain was left uncollected by dusty roads in the countryside as people foraged for roots or ate mud. The book also documents how the attempt to leap into communism resulted in the greatest demolition of property in human history, by far outstripping any of the Second World War bombing campaigns. Up to 40% of all housing was turned into rubble, as homes were pulled down to create fertilizer, to build canteens, to relocate villages, to straighten roads, to make room for a better future, or simply to punish their occupants. The natural world did not escape unscathed either. We will never know the full extent of forest coverage lost during the Great Leap Forward, but a prolonged and intense attack on nature claimed up to half of all trees in some provinces. The rivers and waterways suffered too. Throughout the country, dams and canals, built by hundreds of millions of farmers at great human and economic cost, were for the greatest part rendered useless or even dangerous, resulting in landslides, river silting, soil salinization, and devastating inundations. The significance of the book, thus, is by no means confined to the famine. What it chronicles, often in harrowing detail, is the near collapse of a social and economic system on which Mao had staked his prestige. As the catastrophe unfolded, the chairman lashed out at his critics to maintain his position as the indispensable leader of the party. After the famine came to an end, however, new factional alignments appeared that were strongly opposed to the chairman. To stay in power, he had to turn the country upside down with the Cultural Revolution. The pivotal event in the history of the People's Republic of China was the Great Leap Forward. Any attempt to understand what happened in communist China must start by placing it squarely at the very center of the entire Maoist period. In a far more general way, as the modern world struggles to find a balance between freedom and regulation, the catastrophe unleashed at the time stands as a reminder of how profoundly misplaced is the idea of state planning as an antidote to chaos. The book introduces fresh evidence about the dynamics of power in a one-party state. The politics behind the Great Leap Forward has been studied by political scientists on the basis of official statements, semi-official documents, or Red Guard material released during the Cultural Revolution. But none of these censored sources reveals what happened behind closed doors. The full picture of what was said and done in the corridors of power will be known only once the Central Party Archives in Beijing open their doors to researchers, and this is unlikely to happen in the near future. But the minutes of many key meetings can be found in provincial archives, since local leaders often attended the most important party gatherings and had to be kept informed of developments in Beijing. The archives throw a very different light on the leadership. As some of the top-secret meetings come to light, we see the vicious backstabbing and bullying tactics that took place among party leaders in all their rawness. The portrait that emerges of Mao himself is hardly flattering, and is far removed from the public image he so carefully cultivated. Rambling in his speeches, obsessed with his own role in history, often dwelling on past slights, a master at using his emotions to browbeat his way through a meeting, and above all, insensitive to human loss. We know that Mao was the key architect of the Great Leap Forward, and thus bears the main responsibility for the catastrophe that followed. He had to work hard to push through his vision, bargaining, cajoling, goading, occasionally tormenting or persecuting his colleagues. Unlike Stalin, he did not drag his rivals into a dungeon to have them executed, but he did have the power to remove them from office, terminating their careers and the many privileges which came with the top position in the party. The campaign to overtake Britain started with Chairman Mao, and it ended when he grudgingly allowed his colleagues to return to a more gradual approach in economic planning a few years later. But he would never have been able to prevail if Liu Shaoqi and Zhou Enlai, the next two most powerful party leaders, had acted against him. They, in turn, whipped up support from other senior colleagues as chains of interests and alliances extended all the way down to the village, as is documented here for the first time. Ferocious purges were carried out, as lackluster cadres were replaced with hard, unscrupulous men who trimmed their sails to benefit from the radical winds blowing from Beijing. But most of all, this book brings together two dimensions of the catastrophe that have so far been studied in isolation. We must link up what happened in the corridors of Zhongnanhai, the compound which served as the headquarters of the party in Beijing, with the everyday experiences of ordinary people. With the exception of a few village studies based on interviews, there is simply no social history of the Maoist era, let alone of the famine. And just as the fresh evidence from the archives shows how responsibility for the catastrophe extended far beyond Mao, the profuse documentation which the party compiled on every aspect of daily life under its rule dispels the common notion of the people as mere victims. Despite the vision of social order the regime projected at home and abroad, the party never managed to impose its grand design encountering a degree of covert opposition and subversion that would have been unheard of in any country with an elected government. In contrast to the image of a strictly disciplined communist society, in which errors at the top cause the entire machinery to grind to a halt, the portrait that emerges from archives and interviews is one of a society in disintegration, leaving people to resort to whatever means were available to survive. So destructive was radical collectivization that at every level the population tried to circumvent, undermine, or exploit the master plan, secretly giving full scope to the profit motive that the party tried to eliminate. As famine spread, the very survival of an ordinary person came increasingly to depend on the ability to lie, charm, hide, steal, cheat, pilfer, forage, smuggle, trick, manipulate, or otherwise outwit the state. As Robert Service points out, in the Soviet Union, these phenomena were not so much the grit that stopped the machinery as the oil that prevented the system from coming to a complete standstill. A perfect communist state could not provide enough incentives for people to collaborate, and without some degree of accommodation of the profit motive, it would have destroyed itself. No communist regime would have managed to stay in power for so long without constant infringements of the party line. Survival depended on disobedience. But the many strategies of survival devised by people at all levels, from farmers hiding the grain to local carders cooking the account books, also tended to prolong the life of the regime. They became a part of the system. Obfuscation was the communist way of life. People lied to survive. And as a consequence, information was distorted all the way up to the chairman. The planned economy required huge inputs of accurate data, yet at every level targets were distorted, figures were inflated, and policies which clashed with local interests were ignored. As with the profit motive, individual initiative and critical thought had to be constantly suppressed, and a permanent state of siege developed. Some historians might interpret these acts of survival as evidence of resistance or weapons of the weak pitting peasants against the state. But techniques of survival extended from one end of the social spectrum to the other. Just about everybody, from top to bottom, stole during the famine. So much so that if these were acts of resistance, the party would have collapsed at a very early stage. It may be tempting to glorify what appears at first sight to be a morally appealing culture of resistance by ordinary people, but when food was finite, one individual's gain was all too often another's loss. When farmers hid the grain, the workers outside the village died of hunger. When a factory employee added sand to the flour, somebody down the line was chewing grit. To romanticize what were often utterly desperate ways of surviving is to see the world in black and white, when in reality collectivization forced everybody, at one point or another, to make grim moral compromises. Routine degradations thus went hand in hand with mass destruction. Primo Levi, in his memoir of Auschwitz, notes that survivors are rarely heroes. When somebody places himself above others in a world dominated by the law of survival, his sense of morality changes. In The Drowned and the Saved, Levi called it the grey zone, showing how inmates determined to survive had to stray from their moral values in order to obtain an extra ration. He tried not to judge, but to explain, unwrapping layer by layer the operation of the concentration camps. Understanding the complexity of human behavior in times of catastrophe is one of the aims of this book as well, and the party archives allow us for the first time to get closer to the difficult choices people made half a century ago. Whether in the corridors of power or inside the hut of a starving family far away from the capital. The first two parts of the book explain how and why the Great Leap Forward unfolded, identifying the key turning points and charting the ways in which the lives of millions were shaped by decisions taken by a select few at the top. Part 3 looks at the scale of destruction, from agriculture, industry, trade and housing to the natural environment. Part 4 shows how the grand plan was transformed by the everyday strategies of survival by ordinary people, to produce something that nobody intended and few could quite recognize. In the cities, workers stole, dragged their feet, or actively sabotaged the command economy, while in the countryside, farmers resorted to a whole repertoire of acts of survival, ranging from eating the grain straight from the fields to taking to the road in search of a better life elsewhere. Others robbed granaries, set fire to party offices, assaulted freight trains, and occasionally organized armed rebellions against the regime. But the ability of people to survive was very much limited by their position in an elaborate social hierarchy which pitted the party against the people. And some of these people were more vulnerable than others. Part 5 looks at the lives of children, women, and the elderly. Finally, Part 6 traces the many ways in which people died from accidents, disease, torture, murder, and suicide to starvation. An essay on the sources at the end of the book explains the nature of the archival evidence in more detail. Part 1. The Pursuit of Utopia. Chapter 1. Two Rivals. Stalin's death in 1953 was Mao's liberation. For more than 30 years, Mao had had to play supplicant to the leader of the communist world. From the age of 27, when he was handed his first cash payment of 200 yuan by a Soviet agent to cover the cost of traveling to the founding meeting of the Chinese Communist Party in Shanghai, Mao's life was transformed by Russian funds. He had no qualms about taking the money, and used the Moscow link to lead a ragged band of guerrilla fighters to ultimate power, but not without endless reprimands from Moscow, expulsions from office, and battles over party policy with Soviet advisers. Stalin constantly forced Mao back into the arms of his sworn enemy, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the nationalist Kuomintang that ruled much of China. Stalin placed little faith in Mao and his peasant soldiers, and openly favored Chiang, even after the Kuomintang had presided over a bloody massacre of communists in Shanghai in 1927. For the best part of a decade, Chiang's troops relentlessly hounded and embattled Mao, forcing the communists to find refuge on a mountain base, and then to traverse some 12,500 kilometers towards the north in a retreat later known as the Long March. When Chiang was kidnapped in Xi'an in 1936, Stalin promptly sent a telegram ordering Mao to release his hostage unharmed. After Japan had invaded China a year later, Stalin demanded that Mao again form a united front with his archenemy Chiang, sending planes, arms and advisers to the Kuomintang regime. All Mao got during the Second World War was a plane load of propaganda leaflets. Instead of confronting the Japanese, Mao strengthened his forces in northern China. At the war's end in 1945, Stalin, always the hard pragmatist, signed a treaty of alliance with the Kuomintang, diminishing the prospects of support for the communists in the event of a civil war. Soon after Japan's surrender, full-scale war between the communists and the nationalists resumed. Stalin again stayed on the sidelines, even warning Mao to beware the United States, which had sided with Chiang Kai-shek, now recognized as a world leader in the Allies' defeat of Japan. Mao ignored his advice. The communists eventually gained the upper hand. When they reached the capital, Nanjing, The Soviet Union was one of the few foreign countries to permit its ambassador to flee alongside the Kuomintang. Even when victory seemed inevitable, Stalin continued to keep Mao at arm's length. Everything about him seemed suspicious to the Soviet leader. What kind of communist was afraid of workers? Stalin wondered repeatedly, as Mao stopped his army outside Shanghai for weeks on end, unwilling to take on the task of feeding the city. Mao was a peasant, a caveman Marxist, Stalin determined, after reading translations of the Chinese leader's writings, which he dismissed as feudal. That there was a rebellious and stubborn streak in Mao was clear. His victory over Chiang Kai-shek, forced to retreat all the way to Taiwan, would have been difficult to explain otherwise. But pride and independence were precisely what troubled Stalin so deeply, prone as he was to seeing enemies everywhere. Could this be another Tito, the Yugoslav leader who had been cast out of the communist family for his dissidence against Moscow? Tito was bad enough, and Stalin did not relish the prospect of a regime that had come to power without his help, running a sprawling empire right on his border. Stalin trusted no one, least of all a potential rival who in all probability harbored a long list of grievances. Mao, indeed, never forgot a snub and deeply resented the way he had been treated by Stalin, but he had no one else to turn to for support. The communist regime desperately needed international recognition, as well as economic help, in rebuilding the war-torn country. Mao declared a policy of leaning to one side, swallowing his pride and seeking a rapprochement with the Soviet Union. Several requests to meet Stalin were rebuffed. Then, in December 1949, Mao was finally asked to come to Moscow. But rather than being welcomed as the leader of a great revolution that had brought a quarter of humanity into the communist orbit, he was given the cold shoulder, treated as one guest among many other delegates who had travelled to Moscow to celebrate Stalin's 70th birthday. After a brief meeting, Mao was whisked off to a dacha outside the capital and left to wait in isolation for several weeks for a formal audience. With every passing day, he was made to learn his humble place in a communist brotherhood which revolved entirely around the Soviet dictator. When Mao and Stalin met at last, all he got was $300 million in military aid divided over 5 years. For this paltry sum, Mao had to throw in major territorial concessions, privileges that harked back to the unequal treaties in the 19th century. Soviet control of Lushun, Port Arthur, and of the Chinese Eastern Railway in Manchuria was guaranteed until the mid-1950s. Rights to mineral deposits in Xinjiang, China's westernmost province, also had to be conceded. But Mao did obtain a treaty providing for mutual protection in the event of aggression by Japan or its allies, in particular the United States. Even before Mao and Stalin had signed the Alliance and Friendship Treaty, Kim Il-sung, the communist guerrilla fighter who seized control of the north of Korea after his country's division in 1948, had been contemplating the reunification of the peninsula by military force. Mao supported North Korea, seeing in Kim a communist ally against the United States. The Korean War broke out in June 1950, but it prompted American intervention in defense of the South. Faced with overwhelming air power and tank battalions, an embattled Kim was pushed back all the way to the Sino-North Korean border. Worried that the Americans might cross the Yalu River and attack China, Mao dispatched volunteers to fight in Korea, having been promised air cover by Stalin. A ferocious war followed, the casualties on the Chinese side all the higher as the planes that Stalin had pledged came only sparingly. When the conflict reached a bloody stalemate, Stalin repeatedly obstructed negotiations to bring it to an end. Peace was not in his strategic interests. To add insult to injury, Stalin also demanded payment from China for the Soviet military equipment he had sent to Korea. His death in March 1953 brought about a rapid armistice. For 30 years, Mao had suffered humiliation at the hands of Stalin.